This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Any Stupid Questions, the podcast where comedians ask the experts the questions you really ought to know the answers to at your big age, but don't. Today we're going to be asking almost insultingly basic questions about elections to political journalist and biographer Lewis Baston. Hello, Lewis.
Hello, everyone.
And today's idiots, who I can't believe don't know all this stuff already, are comedy writer Sarah Morgan, who has written Not Going Out on BBC One, The Wilson Save the World on Radio 4, and hosts the excellent podcast The Fear that I've been on. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Danielle.
And also, comedy writer John Morris, whose best known work is now the Ladybird Books for Grown-Ups, but also writes Agendum for Radio 4 and hosts the Rule of Three podcast that I have been on.
We all do each other's podcasts now instead of going to the pub.
Yeah, it's not enough work in comedy writing anymore. You have to fill your days somehow.
And as we all know, no one listens to the end of podcasts. If there's anything you'd like to plug, I'm going to ask you to do it now.
You can go out and buy The Wonderful World of Ladybird Books for Grown-Ups, which is the big coffee table book version of the Ladybird books that's too big to fit in your toilet.
Sarah?
Yes, as mentioned, I do a podcast called The Fear about the overlap between comedy and horror. I interview funny people about what they're scared of.
Lewis, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
If anyone is a publisher or an agent and is interested in a book about borderlands, European borders, how weird it is to live in a place where another country starts the other side of the road, get in touch. Or if you're listening a couple of years from now, please buy my amazing book.
Right, let's talk about elections. Lewis, who gets to call the election? Who does that? Is it the sitting person? Is it the opposition? Is it the Queen? Can we all fill out something on the lottery ballots? I mean, because I'm really confused how this works.
Okay, I think a lot of people are confused at the moment because
yes.
It is technically the Queen.
Is
the Queen
it?
Signs off on all, proclamations and stuff about it. Usually, before 2010, 2011, it was basically a power the Prime Minister had.
Okay.
The Prime Minister could call an election whenever they felt like
when it. When they thought they'd win it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The rules changed a bit, and now it's over to Parliament, really, to call an election. Parliament needs to pass a resolution with a two-thirds majority in order to start a general election. Now, what tends to happen now is the Prime Minister still had the power, as we saw in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Theresa May decided to call an election. Jeremy Corbyn had been saying, let's have an election for months.
Yeah.
So both Labour and Conservative voted for it. It's very difficult to oppose having a new election. And there's a time limit of 5 years. It happens automatically after 5 years, if nothing else is changed. There is one tiny little get-out clause, like if we're in total war or something like this. I shudder to mention this as who knows, it may happen and we may still have this parliament 10 years from now. But during the First World War and the Second World War, it went on longer than the 5 years it should have done.
So what all this stuff about Jeremy Corbyn wants an election,
mm-hmm.
or does he? How can he force it?
He can't force it. You need two-thirds of the House of Commons. So it has to be a kind of collusive thing between the leader of the opposition and the Prime Minister. Now, normally, if you're leading the opposition, you will vote to have an election because what's the alternative? You say to the government, No, you guys carry on. You're doing fine.
Yeah.
We want you in power a bit longer. No opposition's going to do that. So it's effectively the leadership is still with the Prime Minister. If a Prime Minister wants to call an election, you have to have fairly odd circumstances for it not to happen.
Like now?
Jeremy Corbyn would go for it as well.
Is there at the moment a situation where Jeremy Corbyn can say he wants an election and enough of the Conservative Party would want that and Theresa May didn't want an election? Is that what they're trying to manoeuvre?
It's technically possible. What they're trying to do is call an election by another route, and that is to collapse the government. The idea is that there is this thing called a vote of no confidence.
Okay.
And if the majority of the House of Commons votes for a motion that goes, we have no confidence in the government, the Prime Minister then has 14 days for a new government to be formed. And to get
out of what?
Out of someone or other. Out of
star
Labour.
Matter.
Yeah, exactly. We are talking about the coalescence of sort of primal forces here. And if it doesn't happen within the 14 days, then the Parliament fails and there's a general election then. You don't need to get a two-thirds majority for that. You only need a majority of one. So the idea is that if we have some strange, dramatic circumstances, Theresa May wants a no deal or something like that,
yep,
then the idea is enough Conservatives might vote with the opposition in order to collapse the government to stop it happening. That's the strategy. Whether it works or not, I'm probably going to be revealed to be an idiot by the time this goes out.
We'll be in Thunderdomes with cars with spikes on by then. It's fine.
It's really reassuring when everyone just goes, we don't really know.
And also, I really like the idea that the way to get this democracy to work is to keep collapsing things and pulling them down on top of you, like sort of like the Hulk.
Did Theresa May have to call the election in 2017?
Nope. 100% her choice.
Even though she hadn't been the Prime Minister who'd been elected, that was David Cameron.
Yeah, sure.
So she could have just ridden it out.
Absolutely. She could have stayed until 2020 if she'd wanted to. She gambled on getting a better result in the 2017 election than David Cameron had done in 2015. And a sort of mandate. The idea was that there'd be some big Conservative majority, lots of new Conservative MPs who'd be really grateful to Theresa May for winning their seat for them and would do what she said. Didn't turn out that way, of course, and she was stuck with an even worse situation than David Cameron. But this is the thing about we elect MPs. We only elect our MP in our little patch.
Mm-hmm.
The Prime Minister is somebody kind of technically who's chosen by the MPs.
Yeah.
So generally, when you switch Prime Minister midstream, you don't have another election. I mean, Gordon Brown and John Major both came in that way as well. So it was nothing unusual for May to come in 2016 without an election.
Mm-hmm.
What was quite unusual was her messing it up quite so badly when she did go for an election.
If she'd have lost her seat in that election, is she not allowed to be Prime Minister anymore?
This has not been a situation which we've explored yet.
If anyone's going to lose their seat, it's her, isn't it? Yeah.
She could probably manage, yes.
Yeah, Amber Rudd nearly lost her seat.
Yeah.
That was
brilliant.
I suppose it could happen if Amber Rudd became Prime Minister and then lost her seat. Yeah, let's run that through. Probably she'd be so incredibly embarrassed that she would resign as Prime Minister.
Yeah. I don't think Theresa May's ever been embarrassed. Tired? She's definitely been tired. She's been tired.
You can see from her dancing that she has never been embarrassed.
I hate things that talk about politicians' appearance because I think it drags us down to a level that we shouldn't be talking about in Trump's hair and fuck all that noise. But sorry, can I say that? F all that noise.
Stop the BBC.
But Theresa May has been wearing the same mascara for 2 years, and it really upsets me because she's just been applying the same strata of mascara over because she's so tired. She's been awake for such a long time, and it really, really upsets me.
So she should look like Susie Sue by now.
Yeah, she looks like a person who needs to give her 8 hours to catch up with some sleep and then start making decisions.
I wouldn't be able to sleep if I were her. They said that about Margaret Thatcher. She only had 4 hours sleep a night, and thinking, oh, she's a powerhouse. No, she's just really, really, really unable to sleep because of what she done.
All the terrible things going through her head.
Yeah, when you've done bad things, you don't sleep.
But what you're saying is technically, if someone, the leader of party, and for some reason they lost their seat, then they
keep on being Prime Minister until somebody else comes in. And there was, believe it or not, there were a couple of weeks in 1963 when the Prime Minister was not a member of the House of Commons.
Wow.
What happened was that...
Was it Ringo Starr? I mean, anything was possible. Beatlemania had hit.
It was Sir Alec Douglas Hume, and he stepped down from the House of Lords. It was the first year you could step down from the House of Lords. And there was a complete circus about who should be Conservative leader and Prime Minister. And Alec Douglas-Hume stood down from the Lords, so he didn't have a Commons seat. There was, fortunately for him, there was a vacancy in a safe Conservative seat in Scotland, which did used to be a thing, and he was put in as the candidate. So he was in the position of knocking on doors in Perthshire and saying, please vote for me, I'm your local candidate and Prime Minister.
So
like Hugh Grant in Love Actually, the Prime Minister would knock on your door. Oh, simpler times.
What if Theresa May decided to never call another election and you know she's thinking about it? So she just goes, you know what, I am not doing anything for ages. And she bats off all the no confidence votes. What happens on day 5 years? Does it literally just kickstart an election?
Yes, it does, I think. The only way round it, really, is to start a war.
Well, I wouldn't put it past her.
Would they send the army in to get rid of it and prize her off the seat?
Yeah, I mean, like a war with us with another country?
Yeah.
Or just some sort of civil war?
Well, that's...
That's underway, yeah. I mean, because it's the one thing... The House of Lords generally has little power. Can delay a bit or complain a bit.
Yeah.
One thing it really does have power over is that if the House of Commons wants to extend its term of office, the House of Lords has to agree to it, which is what happened sort of after 1940 and after 1915 during the wars then. But short of that, or short of appointing lots of people to the House of Lords so she has a majority and they'll vote to extend Parliament. That's how you... OK, you could theoretically create a dictatorship that way.
But the Tories do have a majority in the House of Lords, don't they?
They're the largest single party. They don't have an overall majority.
Oh, OK.
They're also... The sort of people who end up in the House of Lords tend to be kind of... They tend to be old-fashioned in sort of good ways and bad ways. They don't like governments kind of cutting corners with the Constitution. On the other hand, they're a bit reluctant about, sort of, for instance...
The new 5Ps, they're a bit
But theoretically, she could technically form a dictatorship like that. Just technically.
With a terracotta army of lords.
Technically, yes. You would have to win a... You'd have to get a majority in the House of Commons all the time.
Yeah.
And you would have to stuff the House of Lords. It could be done. What might end up causing you problems is by-elections, because if you keep their MPs there indefinitely, they'll start wandering off, they'll start dying, they'll start getting other jobs, etc. So there'll be by-elections every now and then, and eventually the by-elections will probably get rid of your majority and you'll be defeated in Parliament.
That's checks and balances there.
Eventually
people die.
Yes.
The Grim Reaper, the great checker and balancer.
That is where we are with politics, isn't it?
That's all we've got to hope for.
Fingers crossed someone dies. How many people vote? Oh, you don't have to be like really specific.
Okay,
don't want their names.
Yeah, just like
Aronson.
About 30 million people vote in general elections.
Okay. Is that less than half?
That's
we
about two thirds.
Earlier, didn't we?
We're trying to work out how many it was. Yeah,
yeah. The electorate is about 45 million people,
right?
And turnout is about two thirds of that. Mm. So it's 30 million ish vote in Britain.
High.
Yeah, that surprised me. I assumed
it was seven
lower.
People, but yeah, people, me and my mates.
People like make out is not very many. Mm. And what was the percentage during the referendum?
Referendum was a little higher at 72%. I think turned out in the referendum.
Was that attracting the big red button screw everything constituency more than an election would do?
By all accounts, it was that there were people who didn't vote usually who turned out for that one and then didn't turn out again a year later. One of the things that's really difficult if you're trying to do opinion polling in elections now, it used to be the case sort of 50 years ago, everyone voted, unless there was some really good reason why not. Now you've got, if you're taking a poll, you've got to try and work out who's actually going to vote and who doesn't. Because people, when they're asked by a pollster, are you going to vote? Yes, of course I'm going to vote. And they don't, or at least some of them don't. So that's quite a tricky thing, which means that polling is a more difficult thing than it's been in the past. For other elections, like local government elections, the turnout's lower. It's sort of 30 to 40% in those.
Joel, have you got a question?
It's an obvious one because we have tests for things before you can do things. You have exams and things like that. People have said this before. Why isn't there a test to be able to vote? as in like a really basic one. I mean, just literally like you have to be this high to ride this ride, kind of the thing outside the polling office where you have to be able to tell the difference between, like, say, the Prime Minister and a picture of a traffic light, just to weed out people who genuinely have no
like
interest in politics.
Test.
Yeah, like, can you tick the boxes that have got a car in them? That, when I want to buy something or sign up for a website, I'm tested quite rigorously. I find those quite hard, but I can just walk into a polling station because they put a piece of paper through my door.
Yeah, I've got a certain amount of sympathy for that, but it hasn't been the policy sort of in Britain, at least since 1928. When women and men got the vote on the same
I'm
terms.
Fine about women and men having it. I'm fine with the universal suffrage in theory. It's just, do you know what you're doing in there?
Well, one of the things that is a problem with this is that in the American South, under the semi-apartheid Jim Crow system, they had education tests and so on. And white people would get an education test or sort of put your tick in a box before you're allowed to vote, or kind of name two states of the USA, and the black voters would get a different ballot paper which had some complicated mathematical equations on it. So it wasn't the same test for everyone. And it's just one of these things. It's kind of the rule of large numbers, the idea that the stupid people will cancel out on each side. And it's also not for kind of the state to say, your vote is cast for a really stupid reason. It's kind of something that belongs to you, to every individual, as part of the sort of dignity of being an adult citizen.
Did you have a question, Sam?
This is the most childlike question of all. How come, in a country of X many million people, if more of them vote for a thing than the other, how come that isn't how we decide what won an election? Like the number, like it's not based on the number of votes by individuals, it's based on areas.
Well, there are electoral systems that do work that way. Mm. The presidency of France elections for that work that way.
Lucky sods.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, we do have this very old system of carving the country up into little districts. And the idea was that the MP represents their district, their constituency, and takes that constituency's concerns and wishes to Parliament and represents it there. We had representation of places before we had any kind of real democracy as far as people were concerned. So it's just the way the system has evolved. Other countries do it differently, and they have a combination of nationally representative outcome and district-based things. So you've got a bit of a blend of the two of them.
Mm. So it's a bit like our sort of public transport system when people say, why is our one rubbish? You know, because it was the first.
Yeah.
We were trying it out. I had a question related to that, which I was saying that I remember hearing that we had constituencies because it was hard to travel. So basically, you were sending a village elder on horseback to the central thing.
Yeah.
Now we don't have that. Now we have the internet. We can communicate immediately. Is there a case for getting rid of geographical representation and replacing it by representing your views? So there'd be an MP for people who like Frasier, an MP for people who like salt and vinegar crisps, an MP for people who like cheese and onion crisps, because I'd like someone to represent my views, but I don't feel that that's necessarily where I live.
I think there's something to be said for that. We have that on the London Assembly to some extent. We've got these kind of 11 members who are elected by sort of London as a whole, and they kind of choose what they're most interested in. So in a sense, you can kind of get that. And I do sympathise. I mean, there is this idea that representation is about geography, and it's not necessarily so. It's the way our system has grown up. And there is also some sense, if you want to have a meeting with your MP, for instance, it is quite useful if they're near you rather than if your sort of salt and vinegar eating crisp pervert MP kind of lives in Inverness or whatever. If you live in Plymouth, it's quite difficult to have a chat.
Because there are a bunch of people who are sort of really sort of beating a drum and saying, why can't I vote for the SNP because I live in London? I thought, well, of course you can't vote for an SNP. But then I thought, why can't you vote for the SNP?
Well, it's been done before, because there was after Ireland became independent or became a free state in 1922, there was still an Irish nationalist MP who sat for a constituency in Liverpool. So it can be done.
See, what would be interesting is if the SNP sent a candidate to where you live, then you could vote for them. Are you allowed to do that? Could the SNP run in... Whereabouts do you live?
I live in North London, in Walthamstow.
In Walthamstow. Are they allowed to do that?
There's nothing at all to stop them.
They should do that.
Well, because I was going to ask you about this, because there are maverick MPs, because the party system gets very binary. Mm. What is there to stop MPs who, say, because they are at the moment disagreeing with each other and everything on party lines, just completely atomising. And my MP in Walthamstow, I only found out recently, isn't a Labour MP. She's a Cooperative Party MP who have an alliance with Labour. And I thought, as Labour was splintering, I thought, I wonder if you're going to walk.
Oh.
And apparently it's the third largest party in Parliament is the Cooperative Party, who I'd never heard of. We want a third party. Yeah. And you went, there is one. But I suddenly thought, that made me think, what is there to stop the parties just immediately going, we've had enough of this, and atomising?
The forces that keep them together are about, it's about elections. I mean, the party does a lot for you at election time. If you're an MP, you can win election on the basis of which party you are in a lot of places. Your individual...
Just by habit. People always vote Labour, they always vote
the safe seats.
Yeah, or if people sort of vote Labour or Conservative because of the national campaign and what they think about the leaders and so on, there's a limit to how much you can affect the vote yourself. You can at the edges, but it's mostly about the label you wear. Some MPs can survive if they go independent and stand for elections, but they tend to be the exceptions. I think it's possible we are moving towards a time when parties are kind of breaking down a bit more than they used to be, and that sort of the Cooperative Party, for instance, it's kind of in close alliance with Labour. It's like a sort of, I don't know, I was about to use a metaphor of parasitism, but it is not a parasitic organism on Labour.
Is it like a plate fungus on the side of the tree?
That sort of thing, yes.
Like a bird picking a hippo's tooth? Yeah. Like they need each other.
Remorae on the nose of a shark.
So we've been talking about first past the post, that is our system. The other systems that get talked about are alternative vote, AV, or proportional representation. Which is worse?
I'm no fan of the way we do things. I think first past the post is a pretty crude and rubbish system.
To ask a really stupid question, it's got nothing to do with things actually being first past the post, is it?
No.
The speed of the competition. It sounds like a racing term. It's like the first person to vote wins. That's what it sounds like.
Where they're really rapidly counting those votes. And it's exciting on election.
You see those women always declare. Yeah. Why does Sunderland always win?
The country will be governed once again by Sunderland.
It is nothing to do.
It's just a metaphor.
Just a phrase.
It's a metaphor from horse racing that it's the one horse wins the race and it's the horse that comes in ahead of all the other ones. So that's where it comes from. It's just you vote with an X. They count up how many X's each candidate has. The one candidate with the most X's wins the election. AV is a bit different, alternative vote. You've still got the same thing, one constituency, one MP. But instead of voting with an X, you say one for your favourite, two for your next favourite. And basically, if your favourite candidate gets knocked out, say if you're a Green or a Liberal Democrat or a UKIP supporter, more or less anywhere, your candidate is not going to be one of the top two. But you can choose between the top two. That's sort of how it works.
Okay.
I think it's a slight improvement on what we've got, but only very slight. And PR is a system, it's a generic, general name for any kind of system that seeks to try and link directly the number of MPs to the share of the vote. A PR system has the property where if a party gets about 40% of the vote, it gets about 40% of the seats, which our current system doesn't really do.
No.
You wouldn't want that, it sounds too sane.
It's sane and sensible,
but under that system, wouldn't UKIP have won a lot? They'd have had MPs, wouldn't they, in the last couple of elections because they had a large share of the vote, but it was spread across different constituencies.
That's right, yeah. They got over 10% of the vote, so they'd probably get around 10% of the seats. So there'd be a gang of 50 or 60 UKIP.
What was peculiar is that point of view that UKIP were espousing was the point of view of almost everyone I met.
Yeah.
And it was certainly the view of everyone I sort of met at a boxing day dinner with my family, and yet they had no MPs. And he thought what was weird about the country is that it had no representation for what appeared to be the leader column of the biggest paper in the country had that point of view.
But the weird thing about AV is, because we had a vote on that a few years ago, but I sort of think that was a dream, because no one seems to remember it, do they?
Like, I wrote a book about that referendum and nobody bought it.
Was it a referendum?
If that had gone the other way, would we be in a completely different world?
Oh, goodness.
Is this like the Milliverse all over again?
If the right Miliband, wrong Miliband, depending on... Yeah,
no, the Milliverse is if he hadn't eaten the bacon sandwich, where would we be now?
Okay. Yeah, because I know, like, my family do not remember that AV referendum. Like, they didn't remember it.
It was too boring.
boring.
Yeah,
basically, I'm an electoral systems kind of anorak, and I found that referendum campaign boring. So, my goodness. I suspect what would have, the kind of branching off from that would probably have meant the Clegg Cameron coalition would have had another term. Oh,
which is what Cameron was banking on anyway.
Yep.
Right, that's why we're here.
Hello, thank you for downloading Any Stupid Questions. We hope that you enjoy this podcast, and if you do, it would be absolutely brilliant if you could go on iTunes and rate and review us. Nice rating and reviews. I mean, if you've really hated it, then don't feel you need to tell anybody, but if you did like it, 5 stars and telling your best friends would be very helpful. Thank you.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Why don't we have a system like, I think it's Australia, isn't it, where you have to vote?
Mm.
Why don't we have that? That seems to make sense.
I'm in favour of it myself, because I think one of the problems with the way elections go is the groups who turn out and vote get stuff from the parties. The parties will give them things in manifestos.
Right.
Like you get sort of a television licence if you're over 75 and all that. Old people vote and they get stuff from the government.
Yes.
Mm. Young people don't vote generally and they get stuffed.
And
I mean,
they get
tuition fees and so on, yeah. And rubbish housing and all this sort of thing. So to me, compulsory voting would even up the dialogue a bit. I think also it's quite good that it's a bit of civic duty. There's not much that binds us together as a society and a nation. It's taking part in a little kind of ritual in favour of democracy. And all it involves is marking a little X on a piece of paper, not sacrificing a goat. So I think it's a kind of ritual.
Going to a school near your house.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's warm in there. You're going to see sugar paper for the first time in years.
Oh,
yeah,
lovely.
Fantastic.
You'll be able to text it in soon and then, you know, then the kids will be happy.
Actually, that was a question I was going to ask. Like, considering how foolproof the tiny pencil system seems to be, is there any danger of it being replaced by a computer that could be hacked?
Yes. Some countries have this. And usually it works okay. It depends on the level of trust in the society. The Netherlands has had it for years, and there's no problems there. But often people don't trust the system in the United States, for instance.
They need to see those ladies emptying the big metal boxes.
Oh, yeah. Gives me a sense of confidence about...
Wow,
you can't hack a pencil.
And
top 10 pencil hacks.
Yeah, I'd have a T-shirt that said that.
And I think given the vulnerabilities of systems, as we've seen, that it would be, to my mind, foolish to go over to something that didn't at least have a paper backup.
What's fascinating, isn't like voter fraud is really, really low.
Yeah.
And yet it seems like it would be very easy to do. Are we just very honest?
Well, we assume everyone's honest. It is actually
quite easy to do voter fraud, but there's very little evidence that anyone does it. And there are
that's
very few...
how easy it is to do. No one even notices.
No betrayal.
What usually happens if somebody is defrauding an election, they either make up people to put on the register and then harvest their votes, or they sort of know which people never vote or whatever and vote on their behalf. Those are the commonest types. And in a way, it usually happens only when there's a sort of local councillor who's crooked who wants to make sure they win. It doesn't really happen much on a parliamentary level, because what happens is that they, because the officials check stuff off against the register, if somebody had fraudulently cast my vote, I'd notice when I went to the polling station. I'd say, look, something's gone wrong here.
Yeah.
Are there easier ways to affect the government of the country, like owning a newspaper?
Oh, yeah, I'd definitely go that route.
Crap on a bus.
just sending really, really inflammatory GIFs to certain people on
Facebook.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You don't need to mess around with sort of post boxes and things to...
People have tried to defraud me in the last election. They'd come round to my house and they'd try and tell me who to vote for. Like, I know your game. At what level does my vote have most power? Is it on a local council level? Is it on the constituency level? Is it on the general election? Where have I got most power as a voter?
Well, the people who you vote for are most powerful at the MP level.
Okay.
On the other hand, the chances are you probably live somewhere in a safe seat, so your one vote will not make any difference to the result. So the person you elect has more power, but you individually don't. Mm-hmm. Now, probably when you get down to a local council level, the individual vote you have has more power. You can do more to change a result at local council level. If you talk to several of your friends and so on and you all agree about something and...
And you bundle someone in a van. So you all vote in the same.
Yeah. So you can... But the thing is, your councillor doesn't have a lot of power because councils don't have much money to spend.
Yeah.
Councillors, on the other hand, can affect stuff that happens in your locality. Often the things that you notice from day to day, like... I don't know, in my street, for instance, there were problems with what's called antisocial behaviour, which is often excessively social behaviour of people sort of getting drunk and shouting the odds late at night. And there were sort of issues about establishments in the street. And councillors could do something about that. So sometimes the stuff that makes a difference to your daily life, councillors can do something about, and you've got real leverage over them. But it's understandable why a lot of people feel that Westminster is really remote, because as an individual voter, your power is pretty limited.
Tell you what, I don't remember ever voting in a European election. I don't think I've ever done that.
They were all always tagged onto the end of council elections, I think. When they
got
that other piece of paper.
Bins and stuff, weren't you?
Yeah. And you sort of, yes, it's really odd.
Yeah.
It's really strange that everyone got obsessed with the idea that Europe had too much influence, when I don't think I'd had any influence on Europe.
No.
I certainly not seem to. It didn't seem to interfere with me, even to the extent of asking me to vote for it very much.
Did they used to be? I mean, this is why Brexit's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. Were there European election campaigns?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I don't remember these.
They were pretty perfunctory, really, in Britain. What used to happen is that because of this equal time thing in the broadcasters, you would get Nigel Farage popping up everywhere. So in the Euro elections...
Well, that's where that started.
It is. We can blame balance and proportional representation and all these sensible ideas for unleashing the demon that is Nigel Farage. Because 2009, 2014 European campaigns, that meant he got extra sort of equal time. So he was able to put his argument in a way that he couldn't normally as leader of a minor party.
I mean, it was only him and the two largest newspapers in the country that were saying that. Finally, the voice was heard. If one of the problems with our electoral system is that old people have disproportionate power because they vote, would a way to shake that up be to lower the age of voting, to bring in a rush of excitement about young people voting? Would that balance it up? And then how young should we go? Because I'm thinking really young.
The usual proposal is to lower it to 16. And they do that in Scotland for local elections and stuff like that. So the number of people involved is fairly low. And young people, they don't turn out a huge amount either. So it wouldn't be a kind of dramatic effect. Now, one thing that I saw, which would be really interesting, is young people who wanted to could register to vote from the age of, say, 10 onwards.
Oh.
So that you'd have to actually go out expressly and want to do it.
All those young conservatives.
Oh, and that's
oh.
You never
they're
get
brilliant.
Young Greens.
Oh.
I think it would be fun.
Tiny baby Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh.
people in debating societies.
I love that old footage of William Hague, though.
Oh, yeah, and his baseball cap.
Yeah. Do you think there should be a maximum age limit on voters?
Well, I would be tempted, were it not...
46.
46, that's a... Well, 48. That would be a very good... I speak as a 47-year-old.
I'm older than that. I've just had enough.
The really old people, the thing I love about sort of really old people is that they have a sort of clarity of vision and so on that is given to very few of us.
Like the village elders.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I don't know, I've accepted a lift in an old car, for instance, from a guy who was 90 and had terminal cancer. And I learned so much from that fellow, even though it was absolutely terrifying being in this car with him.
That was with Prince Philip.
And as we turned over and over, I thought, I learned a lot.
Nearly killed a kid, it was.
I learned a lot about not getting to a car with a 96.
But as far as we know, people who are really old, the people who actually did serve in the Second World War, rather than kind of boasting
fantasies about it.
Yes.
Yeah, people who didn't buy Andy McNab ones.
Yeah, people who didn't buy Battle Picture Weekly. So.
Can I ask a question? I don't know if it's hugely relevant to the conversation, but it's all I can think about at the moment. Are we likely to have a second referendum? Does it feel like one's going to happen?
It feels to me like a 1 in 3 kind of shot.
Whoa! What are the other two? What's the other six?
The other two...
Plunging into the sun.
Plunging into the sun. I think plunging into the sun is reasonably possible.
Right.
Okay, good.
And the other possibility, I think, is probably something that looks a bit like Theresa May's agreement, but has
the Chequers
more...
thing.
Yeah, right. The Chequers thing, the withdrawal agreement, perhaps with a bit more kind of customs union... And so on, something a bit closer to...
See, already it just is too complicated. We need sexy binaries. We want flying into the sun or referendum.
That's...
The whole custom... surely everybody's going to go, there's no point, right? This is just,
That's just not Brexit.
Yeah, just rule take another rule maker.
Isn't the problem, as you said, as soon as you've got... You can't undo a binary decision.
Yeah.
With a three-way decision because it doesn't feel like it's got the force of it. Every time I try and think about a second referendum, I go, well, there has to be three choices. Yeah. And then you go, well, then people can argue. The whole reason you're doing it is to try and undo something with something that's exactly the same. Yeah. But the second time round, there can't be two choices. Yeah. At which point you go, oh, God, it's like nine-dimensional chess.
I mean, it's like you've got this... Let's plunge into the sun option.
So plunge into the sun being a metaphor for
sort of...
I literally meant plunge into the sun.
No-deal Brexit, right?
Yes, the no-deal Brexit.
And the risk is, of course, I mean, I kind of feel that a government would be within its rights to say, that's a bloody stupid idea.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have nothing to do with it. Rule it out, put it across the table.
Officially, aren't they voted in to look after the interests of the people?
They are. That is the general kind of overall kind of mission statement of being an MP and being a government.
It's really weird when your MP is David Lammy to have any kind of government. I know, right? Everyone moved to Tottenham. Literally the safest Labour seat in the country. When the Conservatives campaign in Tottenham, the poster is literally a tree. They don't put the word Conservative anywhere on the poster. It's just a little tiny picture of a tree, like, vote for the tree party. Yeah. David Lammy's amazing. Anyway, sorry, carry on. Bias.
Where was I?
Sorry. We were talking about MPs. MPs are meant to represent your best interests, which is obviously...
So they couldn't vote no deal because it'd be damaging.
Yes, that would be damaging for constituents,
But on the other hand, it is a position that is part of the debate, like it or not, and it would be kind of ballsy to kind of take it off the... agenda. So it's a problem. If you give the opportunity for people to crash something into the sun, they may just do it out of perversity.
Well, it seemed to be a lot of the impulse. Whenever you heard arguments about why Brexit had happened, the general, I mean, having read endless articles about it, I've heard loads of articles from one side about why it's a terrible idea, but the articles about why it happened tended to be people wanted to push a big red button. People wanted to kick David Cameron out the window. Weirdly, the phrase no deal and all those, put on the ballot paper, would you like to push the big red button and blow up the country because you're not getting anything? That feels like it would get a lot of votes.
Yeah, if you've got nothing to lose, the nothing to lose button is quite tempting, yeah.
I have to confess, when the campaign was going round, it crossed my mind to vote Brexit because it felt like sticking it to Westminster, who, after, what it would have been 6 years of austerity, you start going, screw these dicks.
The people who were arguing for it were politicians, economists, bankers, the City of London. He went, they're the best people. Everyone likes them.
Yeah.
It was really weird that people turned against them. Because they're the beloved. Everyone, you know, in Mary Poppins, when he comes in and tells the banker he's doing a brilliant job and everyone loves it. They're Britain's favourite people and they said don't do it. So it's really weird people didn't do what they said.
You take the day off feeding pigeons to do some banking. Yeah, that's great.
Is it true? I'm thinking about how we make politics sexier for the kids to get interested in and voting. Is it true you can't take a selfie in a voting booth?
I believe that's true, but it's unenforced.
Why don't we bring it and put in really nice ring lighting, some props?
They dress up.
Some cactuses, that kind of fun stuff that they like in the photo booth. And
Well, I'm about to admit my complicity in an electoral offence.
About time we can all.
in the mid 70s, my mum took me along to a. She was going to vote, and I think it's a childcare thing rather than kind of giving me a kind of dip into democracy. She took me into the voting booth, and that was illegal then.
Oh, is it?
Really? Whereas it is legal now.
Oh, right.
It has been changed, I understand, so that it is now okay to take kids into.
I've let my kid put the cross. But then David Lammy...
That might be illegal.
Got time for one more quick question each. So if you have anything you would like to ask, the stupider the better.
When candidates stand in that row on the hustings, waiting for the results to read out looking like prats, do they already know they've lost?
Yes.
Yes! Oh, that makes it more agonising!
Oh, I didn't know that! I don't know that either!
It is the sort of poker face kind of thing. Whoa. And also for
They're
the people
good.
Who've won, they are good. Like, I remember one election, there was a Labour MP for a marginal seat, and I was sort of looking at his face, and he looked really grim. He looked as if he'd had a rubbish result. And it's then when the result was read out, his face sort of cracked into this beam when he turned out he'd actually held the seat again. And it is an amazing feat. And if you look at the sort of classic footage from 1997 of Stephen Twigg and Michael Portillo standing on that stage, they both kind of had to hold the kind of poker face for so long. And then famously, Stephen's just sort of cracks and beams.
That's going to make the next election so much more fun.
Because you'll be
it's like Drag Race when they take three endings. Yeah. Way too specific.
Do you have a question?
I want to go back to how do we make voting appeal to young people? Mm-hmm. I can't believe when you look at a march, at the Trump march and the Women's March, it's just young people with amazing signs and banners, and they feel like they're hugely political. The young.
Don't get in the polling
booth. But if they don't vote, what
And they like choosing things. They like sort of thumbs up and thumbs down things all the time, binary decisions.
Yeah. They'll do a vote on Metro to which Sex and the City character they're most like. Yeah, but how do we make them...
Maybe you do that in Metro. Which Prime Minister are you most like? And that is then legally binding.
Genuinely, how do we make the young people vote?
My big suggestion for this is the one that came up earlier, right? I just force people to vote they'd find ways of liking it. When an experience is compulsory, you make the best of it. And you actually often people take an interest and do it, feel they want to do it well. But there is a problem here. We've got voting is a really kind of individual, non-networked sort of act. And it's a very low-tech act. Neither of these things really go with the grain. That people want to experience things in a sort of collective network kind of way. And you don't really get that by voting. Mm. And there are very good reasons why you don't, because you don't want to be pressurised by sort of, I don't know, a dominant patriarch or whatever in a family or anything like that. It has to be individual. It has to come from within you. And you're banned from kind of obviously sharing selfies and whatever about how you've done it. So I think it's a problem with democracy. It's not an easy problem to solve by any means. So I would just go straight for the make it compulsory. People will participate and like it, or people will really kick up and react against it, and be very eloquent with their reasons for why they don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And they might have to vote against it. Yeah. That would be, yeah.
But also, I mean, like, if you compulsory voting, I'm all for it. As long as you can have a you know, none no of confidence. The above, yeah. Sure. Or do whatever you want, or, you know.
Draw a knob on the
ballot. Draw a knob.
The danger with that, though, is if you draw a knob by a specific candidate, it could be counted as a vote.
And if that candidate is a knob.
Oh, I think you can say hate crime.
It might look like an X.
Well, I've just labelled John Redwood.
So, but that the risk voting for him, I mean, there's all sorts of, one of the things they do at election counts is they, all the candidates and agents get together and look at all the dubious ballot papers, ones with sort of knobs or symbols or whatever drawn on them.
What a lovely job.
And my favourite one of these is a friend of mine was standing for election and there was one of the doubtful ballot papers that said, I am voting for this bastard. And there was an arrow pointing to his name. And the returning officer said, I think that's a vote for him. And if I may say so, a very perspicacious elector as well.
I have one final question for you, Lewis, as an expert on elections. Yep. Who is the worst ever Prime Minister of Great Britain?
Are we allowed to use current ones or not? I think...
It's entirely your choice.
I think... I mean, to some extent, how... Are they people who couldn't run a bath is one definition. Are they people who screwed up the country is another kind of definition.
I mean, there's lots of definitions of a bad Prime Minister.
Yeah, I would say the real candidates are Anthony Eden, who took office in 1955. Everything was kind of going well. He had an unnecessary war and it was all a complete fiasco and he had to resign in disgrace a year and a half later. That was bad. There was a guy called Viscount Goodrich, who was Prime Minister in the 1820s for a few months, who was pathologically incapable of making a decision. And in fact, used to burst into tears rather than make a decision.
I like this guy.
He's my favourite.
So he eventually...
Can we have him back?
Snowflake.
I mean, I'd take him right now.
He eventually resigned, I think, because he was sick of it. Because the King would say one thing and the Parliament would say the other. Oh, and he'd just sort of stop crying.
Candidate. I want it.
1828 and 27. And... I think you have to say that Theresa May is pretty well up there, in my opinion. I'm sure she has many people who admire her, but to...
Where? Where are they hiding?
But to actually take office with the task of binding the nation together after a referendum, to make it worse, to be ahead in the polls by 20 points and then lose your majority, to have 24 months to complete a task and then get a fail grade when you hand in your papers with hardly any time to go. I think it's going to take a lot of beating.
Holy moly.
Amazing times we live in.
Amazing.
Well, thank you all very much. And thanks to Lewis Baston, Sarah Morgan and Joel Morris. Any Stupid Questions was devised and hosted by me, Danielle Ward, and produced by Ed Morris for the internet. Thank you very much for listening.